We're privileged that Robin will be sharing with us today her understanding and insights from looking at relocation due to climate change and its public health impacts. Thank you.
Well, first, I want to thank Joe for inviting me to present to you this morning, and welcome to Alaska. And then I want to thank Valerie for your really inspiring talk, because this issue that I'm about to talk about is honestly one of the most profound affecting our state. And for all of you who are new to Alaska, you know, in this talk that I'm about to give, I'm very passionate about climate change, and I have learned so much. Like, this entire presentation could not have happened without the Alaska Native tribes that I have learned from and had been advocating about this issue now for quite a long time. So I'm going to start off by giving you a brief overview of climate change and how it's impacting the Arctic. And then I'm going to talk about the implications on community habitability and the need to relocate entire communities because places are submerging because of sea level rise and accelerated rates of erosion. And then I'm going to ask you to think about how you individually can implement protocols and programs within your state to address this really critical issue. So first, climate change and polar amplification. So the UN Framework on Climate Change determined back in 2001 that the polar regions would be experiencing climate impacts and increased temperature at least twice the rate of the lower 48. And one of the reasons for that is because as our Arctic sea ice and snow cover has decreased, it has allowed that solar radiation to absorb into the now dark ground and ocean and increase, create what are called feedback loops that have really led to startling changes in our environment here. So this map, and I'm going to share with you tidbits of how you can pay attention to what's happening with climate change if you're not already doing so. Because honestly, so I will tell you that I've worked on human trafficking issues. I've been working on domestic violence, sexual assault issues for 3 decades. And this is the most critical issue of our times. And to pay attention to it, there are several places you can go. So the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration produces these maps that you can see every month to look at the temperature variation globally. And you can see that in the polar regions, we are like hot red in regard to temperature deviations. And we're at the end of the scale, 5 degrees Celsius increase. This is for February of this year. But it's not an anomaly. So this map is from this past January to March, where you can see in the western part of the state, we are again bright red. And so since December until the end of April, so our winter season and then our spring season, our temperatures have increased average between 5 degrees Fahrenheit and 14 degrees Fahrenheit. And I'm sure you're all well aware that 1 degree Fahrenheit is the difference between freezing and thawing, and the Arctic is melting at a drastic rate, which affects every place on the planet. And so the other place that I always look to figure out how quickly our climate is transforming is what's happening on the Greenland ice sheet. So as some of you may know, the Greenland ice sheet will affect sea level rise all over the planet. And it's actually, its melting is also affecting the gravitational pull of our planet. And that gravitational pull is causing increased sea level rise on the eastern seaboard. So this map that you're seeing is again from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it's from 2012. And what this shows is the melting of Greenland, where in a 4-day time span, so on, let's see, it would be your right, 96% of Greenland was melting in July of 2012, which was, at that point, an anomaly. And unfortunately then, last summer, 50% of Greenland was melting. And I just saw in the paper over the weekend, Secretary of State John Kerry was just in Greenland and alarmed at the melting of Greenland and the implications for sea level rise all over the world. Greenland started melting earlier. Normally it's during the summer months, which are in June, begin in June. Greenland started melting this year in April. The other significant indicator that I look to is what is happening to Arctic sea ice. When I decided, as Megan said, I've worked as a human rights lawyer in Alaska for about three decades, and I decided to go back to graduate school in 2007 because I wanted to understand science. And I was concerned about climate change and felt I needed to understand the science behind it. And at the time that I went back to graduate school to get my PhD in 2007, climate scientists were saying that there would be no Arctic sea ice in the summertime. At the earliest, 2100, outlier 2050, and then Arctic sea ice started significantly disappearing. First in 2007, there was a record low, and then again in September of 2012, the decrease in Arctic sea ice was measured, so this was at the time a record minimum low, was recorded 3 weeks earlier than normal. We have now just passed through, I believe it's January, February, and April of record low Arctic sea ice extent. And now they're predicting that there may be no Arctic sea ice in the summertime as early as 2020. So alarming, because this doesn't only impact the Arctic. This affects the jet stream, and they are contemplating that that's the reason why the East Coast is getting our snow here, that we had a record minimum snow year this past winter, and it was actually the third record minimum snow amount for Alaska. So in Alaska, we don't get hurricanes or cyclones, but we do get hurricane strength winds, and those storms are now increasing in frequency. And I learned a new term this past year called bombogenesis, which is the rapid intensification of a cyclone. So this was a cyclone energy, and I believe wind speeds got up to about 120 miles per hour, that went up through the Bering Strait in November of last year. And so all of these different climate-related impacts have had a tremendous effect on the habitability of the communities in Alaska that are on either the coast, the west coast of Alaska, or on the navigable interior waters. And the U.S. federal government has done a lot of studies about the issue, and the first real study that came out was in 2003, where the Government Accountability Office found that 184 out of 229 Alaska Native villages were being affected by flooding and erosion, and three of those communities were choosing to relocate their entire community because the places where they were no longer able to be protected from those storms that you just saw. And then in 2009, the Government Accountability Office went and did a second study to determine why, when these three communities, and those communities are Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Nutok, why those three communities that had made the decision to relocate, why they still hadn't been able to relocate. And in doing that study, they found that there were actually 12 communities seeking to relocate in Alaska because the places where they lived were no longer able to be safe. And to this day, no community has yet relocated, despite the intense advocacy efforts of the Alaska Native tribes, despite the hard work of state and federal government officers. And the reason is we have no relocation institutional framework in the United States or actually anywhere in the world to address this issue of climate change impacts that cause the places where people live to no longer be safe. So first I want to talk about what is relocation, because in the research community, a lot of different terms have been used to describe this. And so in my mind, relocation is voluntary. It protects people's human rights. It's planned. So relocation is something that you would want to be planning for in the span of a minimum of 5 years to a decade. It's not something that can happen after an extreme weather event like a hurricane, because people are going to be in crisis, and there's going to be a lot of needs for those people when they're in crisis. And then when we're talking about relocation, we're not only talking about infrastructure. A lot of the work that FEMA does, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is about infrastructure. But the relocation that is going to be caused by climate change is going to cause us to have to figure out how people's lives and livelihoods are going to be able to be rebuilt in new places that they may or may not have a connection to. And again, all of this needs to be framed in the context of protecting people's human rights. So what is going to cause community relocation? And while my research has primarily focused on Alaska, I have traveled all over the world talking about this issue. And in my mind, or based actually on the research that I've done here and what I've seen in other places, it's going to be this combination of extreme, repeated extreme weather events like hurricanes, and this slow ongoing process of sea level rise and erosion, which is going to repeatedly damage and destroy infrastructure. So just think of the places where you live. And if a hurricane came or a tornado came and repeatedly damaged and destroyed infrastructure within short time frames, like 5 years, how many times do you think government is going to rebuild that infrastructure, given the resources, limited resources, and whether or not that infrastructure is going to be able to be protected in the future? And so that is the real question before us, is at what point in time should communities be thinking that relocation is their best and only long-term adaptation strategy? So this is a map of Alaska, and it shows the location of those 12 communities that are have been thinking that relocation is their best long-term adaptation strategy. And the communities that I have most closely been working with are on the coast. So you can see in the left-hand corner is Kivalina to the north, and just south of that is Shishmaref. And then furthest to the south is Newtok. And those are the communities that have been working the longest for about 2 decades to orchestrate their community relocation. So Kivalina is an Inupiaq community of about 400 people. They're located on a barrier island. And the reason why I mention Kivalina is because I think maybe some of you in the audience are thinking we're going to have the technology to protect our coastal communities depending on where we live. Well, in Kivalina, they also thought that. And when our former U.S. Senator, Ted Stevens, got the funding for the community to build a seawall, he flew in, I believe it was 2006, to celebrate the completion of the seawall in the community. And that celebration had to be canceled because a storm came in and 180 feet of that seawall was destroyed. And so one of the things that's happening in Alaska as a result of decreased Arctic sea ice is that Arctic sea ice used to protect the communities from the storms coming in. And with that decrease, that Arctic sea ice is no longer able to protect communities. And so they are now relying on seawalls to try to protect them while government representatives try to figure out how to orchestrate the relocation of their community. Newtok is the community that I have worked most closely with. It is a Yupik community located not actually on the coast, but about 12 miles inland from the Bering Sea. And it's located on the Ninglik River, which is causing accelerated rates of erosion. And in Nutak, it's not only the extreme weather events that are causing a massive amount of flooding, but it's also this accelerated rate of erosion. And the community is literally sinking into the ground. If you looked at Nutak from a distance, it looks like it's an island that is slowly being submerged by water. And you can see in the map on this slide, the amount of land that the community of Nutak has lost in a very short period of time. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers determined in, I believe it was 2006, that seawalls couldn't protect the community. And so my research focused on the works of what was called the Nutak Planning Group, which was formed in 2006 because the Nutak Tribal Council had, prior to that, hired a lobbyist in Congress who was able to convince Congress to orchestrate a land exchange between the Native Corporation and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, because the community had determined they had found a relocation site that was across the Ninglik River. People in the community had voted on the chosen relocation site, and then they needed to get land title. Before then, the Nutak Planning Group was formed, and the Nutak Planning Group still exists. It consists of about 25 different federal and state government agencies. I have attended at least 50 of their meetings. And what has been really concerning is these are people who work at state and federal government agencies who are very well experienced in the work that they do, and they have not been able to relocate this community. So when I started attending their meetings, everybody said state, federal, and tribal government representatives, the community needed to be relocated by 2012, and they are still not relocated. There is some infrastructure at their relocation site, but there is no time frame in which government representatives can say at this point in time the community will be able to be relocated and safe. And honestly, it causes me huge distress, because every time these storms come in, there are no, as Valerie was saying, these places, there are no roads to go to leave or to go. And so if storms come in, the only way to exit is by small 10-seater planes, which, depending on how quickly people get knowledge of the storm, might be possible. But for 400 people, that is a huge effort to make sure that people are safe. And so people are not safe in these locations, and we need to figure out ways of making them safe and making the relocation possible. So in doing my research, there are two huge governance issues that impede the ability of government agencies, federal, state, and tribal, to orchestrate a relocation effort. So the issue affecting Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Nutak is that there are no state or federal government agencies in the United States that have a mandate to facilitate a community relocation, which means there's no orchestrated funding. So in the context of what's happened with the Nutak Planning Group, each of those 25 federal, state, and tribal government agencies have had needed to learn the organizational capacity, the financial capability, to figure out how they could leverage the resources that each government agency has and make relocation possible in a timely manner. And obviously, it has been so complex that that has not happened. So that's one issue that we need to really figure out. But the other issue that I'm actually more concerned about is, at what point in time should communities think about relocating? And that's where your expertise becomes really critical. So as Megan said, We were really fortunate. It's because of the tribe's advocacy efforts with the White House and Congress that this has taken, I would say, priority within the Obama White House. And in 2014, I believe, there was a task force report that was done by the state, federal, and tribal governments, and we were honored to have Mayor Reggie Jewell, who is from the Northwest Arctic Borough, who was on that task force. And he, in that task force, they recognized this institutional challenge. And it's in that context that I have been working with the White House to try to problem solve this so that other communities outside of Alaska aren't faced with this crisis. And so in trying to conceive of what this could possibly look like in regard to a relocation institutional framework that is based in human rights, and the reason why it needs to be based in human rights is we have a horrific legacy in the United States of forcibly relocating primarily indigenous peoples, and that happened here in Alaska during World War II. That has led to the impoverishment of the people being relocated. So this right to self-determination and the ability to make these decisions is absolutely critical. What's also really important is that we always start with protection in place. Obviously, communities need to be protected where they are for as long as they can be, but then we need to come up with what I call relocation indicators. What would those indicators be that would determine that it's no longer possible for that community to stay where they are, so that you have this planned relocation process? And we are really fortunate that we've received funding from NOAA and the National Science Foundation to try to start actually designing and implementing this adaptive governance framework with 14 of the most imminently threatened tribes, threatened by flooding and erosion. And so here's what we are trying to do. We are trying to design what we're calling community-based monitoring of environmental change, which is happening. But what is not happening is that community-based environmental change isn't being done with government agencies that can provide technical assistance and funding to make not only that the monitoring of the environmental change, to bring it up to a higher scale, but also so that those communities can get access to the resources that they need. And those environmental changes need to be connected to people's health and well-being. And so we are trying to design a community-based health monitoring system. And because obviously climate change is going to impact community health and people, as I said, the right to self-determination, people in communities need to understand the changes that climate change is bringing to their community. And so if any of you are working on community-based health monitoring, where it's actually the communities themselves doing the monitoring, this is not about technical experts coming in and doing an assessment. It is providing the tools for communities to do that with your expertise so that there's this ongoing dynamic process of monitoring health impacts as climate change increases. And some of the community health impacts are going to be infectious respiratory diseases and increased rates of food and waterborne disease. So please come up to me if you're working on this, because we are trying to design this here in Alaska. And why this is important to all of you who live outside of Alaska. So, as I mentioned, the decrease in Arctic sea ice is having a profound impact all over the planet. To the right, you can see Miami. So, in Miami, they are now experiencing what NOAA calls nuisance flooding, which has increased dramatically over the last few years. And if you're in southeast Florida, seawalls can't protect you because the ground on which Miami rests, southeast Florida, is porous. And so the water is actually not only coming from the ocean, but coming up from underneath, and there are 6 million people who live in Southeast Florida, and there is no plan. And I was just there speaking at a conference. The mayor of Coral Gables, which is one of the wealthiest communities within the Miami Beach area, has asked for a legal opinion about what his responsibilities are to the residents of Coral Gables, because he knows he's not going to be able to continue to provide those services as sea level rise continues to impact the public infrastructure within his community. And then, of course, there's Hurricane Sandy and Lower Manhattan. I'm originally from New York. I was there when Hurricane Sandy happened. And there's no plan for Lower Manhattan. They've come up with a lot of ideas of how they're going to try to protect Lower Manhattan and possibly, you know, the Queens area and Long Island. But there is no plan because it's really expensive. And when you're talking about unknown amounts of sea level rise, the reality is that places may not be able to be protected, and we need to start conceiving of how populations are going to be relocated. So in closing, I'm going to bring us up to the international level, because if you've been paying attention to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, there was just a lot of success noted around the Paris Agreement. And while it was a success that we had governments all over the world recognizing that climate change is a critical issue that we all need to be dealing with, the actual agreement falls far short of what we need in order to prevent the climate crisis that is currently happening here in Alaska and that will happen in other parts of the world. So in the preamble, the negotiators were hoping to keep our temperature increases to 2 degrees Celsius, and hopefully 1.5 degrees Celsius. But I've already told you here in Alaska, we've increased our temperatures in Celsius terms to 3.5 degrees Celsius during the winter time. And based on those NOAA maps that I just showed you, some scientists are saying we're already at the 2 degrees Celsius mark. And then finally, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change recognized the importance of human rights protections in this context. And you'll see the right to health is one of those critical human rights that need to be protected as climate change causes crises all over the world. Thank you.
Okay, so now let's go ahead and open it up for questions. We've got until, I think, 9 o'clock. So please come up to the microphones with questions. As we're waiting for people to come to the microphones, you know, one of the things I guess maybe I'll just start with is here in Alaska, we're working on a climate change health impact assessment. Right now, we're hoping to get it out maybe in the next month or so. It's about a 90-page HIA that looks at all the different health effects categories like psychosocial, accidents and injury, chronic disease, infectious disease, and exposure to hazardous materials. And we're really excited about it. It will basically provide a framework for people who are doing climate change work in Alaska to work from. So please go ahead with the first question.
Thank you. I'm Lauren Thieb from North Carolina, and really appreciate both of the talks I heard. And my question was for Robin, something I keep hearing from colleagues working with these lower resource communities that are deeply impacted by climate change and sea level rise risk, is the difficulty of communicating the threats and then also finding something actionable so the community is just not paralyzed with, you know, not being able to do anything or lack of resources. And so I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit about what your experience has been with kind of talking with communities and maybe exploring what their options are.
Sure. Thank you for the question. So this is the reason that we are creating what we're calling this community-based monitoring and assessing that happens along with government agencies that can provide the technical resources and funding to facilitate adaptation. because the documentation of environmental change and its impact on communities is not enough to get communities access to those resources unless there's a coordinated effort to do the documentation along with these entities that could provide the resources. And the other reason is adaptation is going to be forever, and we need to create systems in place that can be dynamic and set up a coordinated response at a local level. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, but it's really got to be like community specific and get those people, all of the different rights holders and stakeholders to the table to develop a plan of how they're going to monitor the changes and then get access to the resources.